predicts one thing and you can predict it. He was so smart. And I felt like I knew him better than he knew himself right away. That's very powerful. You liked how he tucked in his shirt? I was intrigued. I was repulsed. No, I knew how he tucked in his shirt. It's different. And I was flattered. He was just out of graduate school, a big deal on campus for an article he'd published in Nature, and he said to me, oh, maybe a month or so in, that he hadn't told me everything about himself. He said he wanted to tell me everything. And you know, I was 19. I was like, oh no, he's a felon or a pervert or something. I was just a kid. He wasn't a pervert, I said. No, nothing like that. He just wanted to tell me about his religion. He was a third-generation Christian Scientist, and I laughed at him when he said it. I was so relieved. I was really afraid of what he'd say. By then I could see Leo coming down the street. He was shading his eyes with his hand, scanning the crowd for the car. He had two backpacks over his shoulder, mine and Paul's together, and the big rolling suitcase in one hand. He was half trotting as he went, khaki shorts bunching in the crotch, exposing his pale thighs. What happened then? I asked Petra, feeling urgent about it now. What I meant was, what are you trying to say to me? I felt that I'd missed something along the way, that the essential part of the story had already come and gone while I'd been looking out the window. Oh, I don't know. She must have seen Leo too then, because her voice changed, lowered, and glazed over. Got sweet and cool, almost arch. I laughed at how serious he was. Then I married him. I liked that he was serious, and I thought I stood apart. Together we watched as Leo caught sight of the car. He went around back and loaded the trunk. Clearly he couldn't see us inside, staring right at him, because when he came back around, when he saw his reflection in the car window, he took a deep breath and flattened down a tuft of blown hair at the top of his head. He plucked his shorts out from between his crotch with two fingers. But that wasn't all.
Watch,
Petra whispered. An instant before Leo opened the door, he slid his flattened hands an inch beneath his belt and shoved his blue cotton shirt in deeper. It was an automatic gesture, and he looked a little flustered, as if he wasn't sure whether he'd be welcomed back in the car, or what he'd find when he opened the door. Petra said to me, "You think you're as old as the ages when you're 19? That your years pass being grown up, you'll see." "Everything okay in here?" Leo asked, sitting down hard in the driver's seat. Petra leaned forward, kissed the lobe of his ear. He swung around to study Paul's sleeping face, then Petra's. "We're okay," I answered, for her. The car ride home reshuffled things. The whole way, Leo asked me polite but absentee questions about lake fishing and iron ore, and it was Petra who whispered games to Paul in the back seat. We sat in the construction traffic outside Duluth even longer this time around. Through it all, through the orange dust and the black exhaust, Leo spoke to me without turning his head, nodding and noncommittal about my answers. I stopped answering with more than a few words, and finally, he stopped asking. An hour, 2 hours of silence opened up between us. Nobody suggested we stop at Denny's on the way back. Once the construction ended, I started looking for landmarks I remembered from the day before. The purple water tower, the tunnel blasted through the hillside. But everything looked different from the other direction, and I couldn't anticipate when these landmarks would appear. I only recognized them in retrospect, the moment we passed, and I had to turn around and watch the water tower receding in the window. "Almost home," Leo cried triumphantly, when the tunnel spat us out. He seemed resolved to this idea long before it was an accurate description of our circumstances. By the time we got to the old familiar highways, the ones I'd walked for years, Leo had been saying "almost home" for more than an hour. Then, Loose River appeared in the dappled sun of the deep woods, and Leo was so elated he broke into a round of "Good King Wenceslas." Patra joined him in an obedient soprano. My heart disobediently sank. "We're back," Leo announced, when Patra trailed off in the middle of the second verse. So I slid my hands under my butt and imagined the car breaking down, or a wretched deer in the road, or any kind of calamitous barrier. I didn't offer to get out and walk up the sumac trail. I let Leo scrape up his car driving through that dense corridor of trees in the early evening shadows. Slowly, slowly, I retrieved my backpack from the trunk. "Night," Leo called through his open car window, turning the Honda around as soon as I slammed the trunk. I didn't hear if Patra or Paul said anything. The backseat window was rolled up tight. "Surely," they said to me later, "surely by then you sensed something was off." Maybe. Maybe there is a way to climb above everything. Some special ladder or insight. Some optical vantage point that allows a clear, unobstructed view of things. Maybe this way of seeing comes naturally to some people, and good for them if it does. But I remember it all, even now, as if two mutually exclusive things happened. First, it goes the way the prosecutors described it. Nausea, headaches, coma, etc. And then it comes back to me the way it actually was with Patra and Paul. Tall ships, car ride home, good King Wenceslas, bed. Though they end the same way, these are not the same story. Maybe if I'd been someone else, I'd see it differently. But isn't that the crux of the problem? Wouldn't we all act differently if we were someone else? "Back early?" my mother asked when I pushed open the cabin door. She was waiting for an answer, even though I'd killed some time before coming inside, even though I'd sat against my backpack behind the shed for more than an hour with the dogs. I hoped to avoid this exact question. "Madeline?" I couldn't see her clearly, though. She was a hunchbacked shadow at the table. She had been stitching something or trying to read, I couldn't tell. I didn't say anything to her, just found my way across the dim roof with my backpack and climbed straight up the ladder to my loft. My mother hadn't yet turned the lights on, of course. So I remember thinking, fine, let it be night. It was probably only 8:30 or 9, nearly the longest day, but the cabin was already dark from being enveloped so completely on all sides by pines. I remember Patra's headband pressing into my skull as I rolled onto my mattress and relishing the wonderful ache of it. I remember the click of the lamp and my mother's curse before she went outside and fumbled behind the cabin for the generator. I remember that when the lights came on, it was like a jolt to the skin, and that my mother stood breathing for a moment at the foot of my ladder. "Madeline!" she asked again. She jiggled one of the lower rungs, made the joints creak. I burrowed into my sleeping bag, fully dressed. "Have a good time in Duluth?" "Night," I thought. After a few minutes, I heard the pine boards groan as she walked to the sink. I heard her swing open a cupboard, bite into one of the pears I'd bought a week ago in town, bite, then pause. I imagined her pulling threads of wet peel through her teeth with her fingers. I could hear her breathing loudly through her nose, and humming the same two lines from two totally different songs, mixing them together. "Strange days have found us, casting down their crowns along the glassy sea." My mother, That night, as I lay in bed that night after going to Duluth and back, I remember how loudly the moths buzzed around the lamp she'd turned on. I remember the feathering of their wings against the bulb and that endless pear in her mouth, crunch, crunch, crunching. I remember her humming, pushing out more air than sound, and how all that plus my pounding head made it impossible to fall asleep. Part 2. Health. Chapter 12. She's a corporate executive, I swear to God, my mom used to say to my father. She's done an inventory of the pines on the hill. The pillows. 12 big pines, I'd think, when she did this. 2 pillows and 7 blankets. I was probably 6 or 7 when my mom started calling me a CEO. I could still climb onto my father's lap in my cotton nightgown and pretend I was smaller, a little girl he could hold and protect. Or, better yet, a piece of equipment he could use. A wonderful, worn tool that needed tending, like the tape measure he returned with such care to his leather belt. I curled up my legs inside my nightgown to try it out, put the tip of my thumb inside my mouth, and began chewing the nail. "Take care," my father warned me. "There's walls of wood nettles out by the..." For a moment, his arms were around me. He spoke into the back of my head, and it was almost, though not quite, like being petted. I could feel his breath on my scalp, his words before they were words in the rumble of his chest. Then he shifted, as if trying to scoot out from under me. He was tired. I know that now. He was tired in a way that made him seem absent, slow, hauling up some viscous thought he couldn't quite identify without putting everything else on hold for a moment. My mother and I waited for him. "She's got such a pissy look," my mother finally said, laughing at me. "Look at that look!" "Just don't go counting things near the highway," my father finished. I slid very slowly from the cliff of his lap. Since Tamika and the big kids left, I almost never even left sight of the bunkhouse and cabin. I let one leg go first, then the other, thinking my father might pull me back up. Then I lay on the floor, looked at the wormy brown laces of his boots. "Seriously," my mother said. "She told me she wants to measure the cabin. And she's counted our dishes, apparently. We still have all 16 spoons."
"Children like to count," my father said, knowingly.
"This one's got a talent for it." On the floor, I bit into my father's bootlace, chewed for a moment. I could tell by the way he cleared his throat that he was getting ready to stand up, head for the shed. There wasn't ever anywhere to go inside. There were only 2 rooms on the ground floor, the kitchen space and the bedroom, plus a stepladder to the loft, where I slept on a goose feather mattress jammed against rafters. The loft was a particle board platform. The bedding was a pile of Army-issue sleeping bags that smelled of mildew and smoke. From the low ceiling hung a yellow cloth with black cats smoking cigarettes in an intricate, dizzying pattern. My mom drew this around my sleeping bags when I slept, unless it was too cold, unless it was winter. Then my father slung the old mattress over his shoulder like the body of a disheveled fat person he loved and wished to save. He hoisted it down the ladder and laid it by the stove. "Sleep," he told me, straightening the mattress creases with a wide red hand.
"Get a good dream."
He patted an old jacket into a pillow-like shape. He was kind to objects. With people, he was a little afraid. Winters were especially confining. We were all tied, as if by rope, to that sooty black furnace, which has a certain romance, I know, if you tell the story right, a certain Victorian ghost story earnestness people like.
and I've told the story that way to the delight of shark-tooth-wearing dates and coffee shops. So many people, even now, admire privation. They think it sharpens you, the way beauty does, into something that might hurt them. They calculate their own strengths against it, unconsciously, preparing to pity you or fight. Like that mechanic I dated in St. Paul. Eventually he got tired of sneaking out of my bed in the morning. He made me come to his apartment to see him. He got me drunk one night, fed me burritos. He laid out tarot cards in rows on his blue carpet, pointed at the gargoyle face of the fool, and asked what I thought. Apparently, he'd been a psychology major before he was a mechanic. He had a thing for Carl Jung, as well as an intimate knowledge of carburetors. He wanted to excavate my past. "Isn't this supposed to tell the future?" I asked, sitting cross-legged on his floor. I was just tipsy enough to give him a hard time. "It's tea leaves, babe, not magic." "Ah. You give me superstition, not the good stuff. I promise this'll be good." He scooted closer to me on his knees, held up one finger. "Give me a second. What does this card make you think?" "That fool looks like pretty easy prey, if you ask me. His eyes are closed." "Okay, that's perfect. What else?" "Does he have, like, a pig on his stick? I think that's a rucksack." I narrowed my eyes. "Where'd you learn to read tarot again?" He narrowed his eyes back. He was smiling, though. "Who was easy prey in your childhood? Did I ever tell you I know quite a lot about wolves?" "Ha! The Girl Scout. I know her. The Girl Scout comes out whenever you're nervous." "Like, I'm your wolf expert. Ask me anything." "Who was easy prey, then?" The truth was, that old wood stove was narcotic and banal to me as a child. So I was drawn to it without seeing it, and hated it without wondering why. The winter I was 9, I laid my cheek against it while I was reading Mush, a manual, on the floor. The burn made a bubble of clear skin, a round half-globe like the air bladder of a fish under my left eye. The bubble grew as the days passed, rose translucently from my face, obstructed my vision when I looked down. If my parents noticed, they didn't draw attention to it. At school, I made excuses to go to the bathroom and poke at it in the mirror. Sometimes Sarah, the ice skater, would be there too, leaving class early so she could change before practice. Sucking a blow pop, snapping a leotard under her crotch. "Sick," she'd say, peering at my reflection in the mirror and touching her own cheek. And once, coming closer, getting curious, "Did your dad do that to you? Is that the kind of thing they do to you?" I had two chores to do with my dad: chop wood and clean fish. By the time I was 10, I could chop whole logs on my own, so my dad gave up that chore for me to do alone. But we did the fish together until I was in high school, working quietly over a pair of buckets in the shed. We used bleached fillet knives that we scraped against the whetstone before starting. And that was the best part, always, the gravelly, ringing drag of steel over rock. The sound made the hairs on my arms prickle up. My teeth ache pleasurably. Then there was just the sluice and slop of skins coming off. There were our two fist-sized puffs of breath punching the air side by side. My father's and mine. Ha. Ha. The fish and wood only took a few hours, so I used to make up extra chores for myself. When I was in fourth grade, I started writing down the good deals at Mr. Korhonen's on toothpaste and toilet paper so we wouldn't run out, and I passed these lists to my mom before she went into town. I took over care of the dogs the winter I was 11. I began feeding the stove in the mornings because I woke so early for the dogs. Later, just before I started middle school, I saw it as my responsibility to sit with my dad on Sunday afternoons and listen to ball games and a Prairie Home Companion. My dad told me once that he'd had a class with Garrison Keillor in college, and for years I imagined Garrison as one of the relatives I'd never met. I thought of him as my dad's gregarious older brother, and my dad as the shy younger one, who could handle himself better against loneliness and disaster. I didn't have any regular chores to do for my mom. She couldn't bear to have me around when she washed clothes or cooked dinner. She said I was too slow, too judgmental. She said I watched too closely for mistakes. You act like I'm being wasteful when I take off the littlest bit of potato with the peel. My mother was inattentively industrious, full of ideas. She had all kinds of do-gooder projects strewn on the table and chairs, stations of interrupted activity, quilting scraps for inmates, letters to protest chemical spills, Bible quotes she copied onto index cards, thrift store mystery novels, a years-long scheme that involved reading Russian fairy tales from a book she never returned to the library. Her long hair always fingered the air as she moved across the cabin. It clung with static electricity to everything she touched, pot handles, broom handles, my face when she bent over me. "Are you still oiling the same old reel?" she'd demand. "How is that possible?" Her hair snapped when she moved away. It bothered her that I wouldn't play her games, that I refused to read out loud or dress up as a dragon in the rag she wound around my body and called a tail. "Roar," she used to say, coaxing, pulling my hair. She crossed her eyes, tried to provoke me. She stuck out her tongue and I could see a white film like a layer of moss over the pink. Then I would think, "We need toothpaste." I would add it mentally to my list, toothpaste, mouthwash, floss. "When I was your age, I wrote a novel," my mother told me. "I put on Macbeth in my parents' backyard with a cast of 20 characters. It was a funny version, actually." She scrunched up her face and spoke with an exaggerated British accent. "Out! Out, damned Scott!" She waited for me to laugh, but I wasn't sure what part was funny. "Here," she said, then sighing, and handed me a wand she'd made from a birch branch rolled in glue and glitter. She wanted very badly for me to cavort and pretend, to prove I was unharmed, happy. During those years, she went to church on Saturdays as well as Sundays, to the Catholic and Lutheran services as well as the interfaith one, to cover all her bases. She never asked me to go along. She said she was a religion mutt. She couldn't decide what mattered most, good works or God's grace. She couldn't settle the sacrament of blood, man's flesh, or empty metaphor. "Both sort of suck," she said, when discouraged. What she did know, and believed with all her heart, was that it was some combination of private school and television that had corrupted her mind and cheapened her natural talents. "Look at the freedom you have!" She said this when she was the most exasperated with me, throwing open her arms, as if all her rags and rocks and jars of sand were a form of rarest treasure, as if she had saved up her whole life to acquire this hoard of scraps. Sometimes, to please her, I wore her dragon tail out to train the dogs. The summer I was 12, I was transitioning them from sled to search and rescue. They each had a different reward, a broken paddle, a rubber hose, a tennis ball I'd found at the high school courts. I'd unchain one dog at a time, tell him to stay, and duck behind a tree trunk. But that was too easy. Each one found me every time. So one summer afternoon, after trying all the familiar places, I dashed behind the house and scaled the back of the shed, dragging my dragon's tail over broken shingles. Then I gave the signal to look, a high-pitched whistle, and watched Abe go for all the old pines, sniff upwind and down, run in frantic circles around the cabin. Abe wasn't an old dog then, but after 20 minutes, he was panting hard and flinging saliva in wide arcs across the yard. A half hour passed, 45 minutes. The other dogs heaved on their chains, joining his distress. From above, I watched Abe's ribs swell and contract. I watched him try the same spots over and over again. I watched him stumble once in exhaustion. I sat still on the roof of the shed. As an experiment, I put my own mouth on the scummy rubber fuzz of the tennis ball in my hand. The moment before I gagged, before I choked and spit it out, a queer euphoria lifted me up, as if by wings. "Really? Ask me anything," I said, pulling the extra tarot cards into a stack on the mechanic's carpet in St. Paul. His name was Rom. He had bright blue eyes, big, muscly arms, a paunch. The stud in his tongue flashed at me when he yawned, so I poked him in the chest. "Ask me. How often do wolves eat?" "And I'll tell you, every 4 or 5 days. They straight out starve. Then they gorge like, I know this one, teenage girls. They're never going to eat again. Now ask me, what do they eat?" "Ask it." He shook his head, but played along. "What do they eat? White-tailed deer. Also worms and blueberries. Keep it coming, Girl Scout. Keep stuffing it all back down in the unconscious. And dogs." "There was this little town in Alaska, middle of Nowheresville. Isn't that where you're from?" He raised his eyebrows. "And they came at night and got someone's lab. Just chomp. Then the next night, it was a couple of huskies who never even made a sound. The final blow was someone's pretty coon hound, one of those long-snouted things, a winner of dog shows. She was eaten right off her chain, just her collar left behind, and, you know, her jawbone and tail." "Jawbone and tail. An album title. Wolves eat most of the bones, usually. That's a Girl Scout tip." "So, what happened in Nowheresville?" He was leaning in closer to me now, was murmuring into my neck. "Who saved the rest of the dogs?" "No," I pushed him back. "Who saved the wolves?" "They were all shot." The fall I started middle school, my mom stopped calling me CEO and started calling me the teenager. This was because I was always stealing magazines from the secretary's office at school, reading People or Us or Glamour. I read about procedures for blow-drying your hair so it looked like a tornado had come to town, and I studied tips for slicking down bangs so they looked wet. I never had any interest in trying these looks. What I liked seeing was something so mysterious broken down into steps, pieced together in charts and tables. Or if there weren't any new magazines in the office, I got books from the library on Ice Age paleontology and the history of electricity. I coveted diagrams of hairstyles or skeletons, ink drawings of angles and equations I didn't understand. My mother didn't see me reading these things because I wasn't doing anything she found interesting. Instead, she'd be setting out jars for jam or copying a quote on a pink index card. And when she'd glance up, she'd look right through me. I didn't watch TV until I lived in Minneapolis with Anne. But when I did, I recognized the feeling. To look at somebody who can't look back. Occasionally, she'd see me reading and peer at the book over my shoulder. "Is that for homework?" she'd ask, shaking her head in amazement. I knew she wanted me to do well in school, but she wanted me to succeed the way she had, by disdaining the whole process. It bothered her to think I was trying, Oh, you're becoming such a little professor, aren't you? We should get you one of those gowns. She was glancing down at a drawing of a velociraptor in my book, its bones labeled with arrows. She seemed one part surprised, maybe even pleased, but two parts disparaging and contemptuous.
Don't give me that look, she'd laugh.
I was 12. My whole life I'd been unintentionally giving her looks she didn't like.
You'd be impressive in one of those gowns, like a pope.
She widened her eyes at me.
I'm kidding!
Listen, I'm not saying there's no system at all. That's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is that there's an order on a higher level than school, and it's worth paying attention to the relative elevation of things. God, man, bureaucracy, worksheets. She sighed.
When they say at school, do this worksheet and the next one and on, you need to see. It's really important that you see. Those aren't steps that go on up higher. It's just a fake kind of higher. Does that make sense?
What's this? She asked me once, when she found a People magazine on the table, left open to an article about Princess Diana. I was fascinated by her sadness for a while, by how pretty as she was, she could not keep it to herself. I read about her little boys, her husband's affairs, her eating disorder, her lipstick pairings, her stockings, her high heels. I found an article after her divorce in which she'd made a list of her morning routine, which included, think positively even if you have bad dreams. That seemed both pitiful and brave to me, poignant. My mother, however, turned the slick People pages in complete puzzlement, saying, did you read this whole article? I don't understand you. What is there in that thing to read? Once near the beginning of seventh grade, I went to the bathroom, and Sarah the ice skater was there with another girl, combing sparkly gel into her hair. It was Lily Holburn, who looked stricken. Her slick black hair came to a point like a stake behind her back. Oh, the freak, Sarah said when she saw me. But she seemed interested rather than disgusted, searching my face for a sign of the popped bubble. There wasn't any, except maybe the spot on my cheek that was less deeply tanned. Lily squeezed one eye shut, a line of gel leaking down her forehead. Hey, I said warily. I knew Sarah was to be respected. I'd heard she had already landed a double axel, one-footed, fully rotated, and I believed it. Her body was like a pulled wet branch, her taut muscles holding some weird snap that seemed mechanical and a little dangerous. Everyone assumed that triples hung in her future, that they followed her magically wherever she went, dangled just out of her reach. Triple sow cow, triple loop, triple flip, triple Lutz. That meant Upper Great Lakes, Midwesterns, Nationals, Worlds. Lily, on the other hand, was not what People considered athletic. Still, Sarah had befriended her in the months after her mother died and convinced her and two other medium pretty girls, both blondes, to join synchronized skating. It wasn't charity, Sarah's interest. Though Lily wasn't called Indian anymore, no one was calling her retarded the way they once did, either. The Lunettes needed people with poise, Sarah told her, all smiles. Boobs, she meant. Which was why Lily was standing in the seventh grade bathroom with Sarah's greasy hands in her hair, glitter everywhere, a gob of it now on her cheek. The Lunettes had a competition that afternoon in Duluth. Lil, don't look at the freak, Sarah said, as I squeezed past them to get to the stall. Her dad, you know, tortures her for fun. That's what they do in that cult where she grew up. They burn her face with wax. They force her to pee outside so she doesn't know how to use a toilet. Lily's brown eyes met mine in the mirror. For an instant, I had the sensation I was looking at myself. And when I saw my own gaunt face beside hers, I was startled.
Her face looks okay to me.
Lily hedged. She leaned forward, so Sarah pulled back on her hair like reins.
I've seen what they do. Have you seen it? Have you?
No, Lily acknowledged. I said nothing. On the floor of the stall lay the detritus of a quick change. Jeans, padded bras, a pair of off-white underwear in a wad. I nudged the pile out of the way with a toe, sat down, but could squeeze nothing out.
Hiss, hiss, went the hairspray, on and on, with no change.
They were listening.
Sorry, Lily mumbled when I came out, bladder full, humiliated.
About the clothes.
Don't talk to freaks!
Sarah started spraying Lily's face. Close your eyes! Lily did, but Sarah's eyes met mine as I rinsed the tips of my fingers under the faucet. It was the kind of look the dogs gave me when they had a meaty bone in the corner of the shed.
Let's sing,
Sarah said to Lily, who was cracking open her eyes.
Let's sing One Tin Soldier.
When Lily didn't join in, Sarah gave her a prodding kick in the shins. You need to believe in the song, she said.
I wish I believed in this shit,
my mother said the morning she baptized me. I was 6, maybe 7 years old. A slant of light from the doorway caught her face. Cold well water from the measuring cup trickled down my back.
What shit?
I asked, shivering.
Like that, like, no more saying shit, okay? You're a new pot of rice, baby. I'm starting you all over from scratch.
I'm not hungry yet, I told her. She laughed, helped me out of the metal tub.
All you gotta do, hon, all you gotta do is be a kid. You do that, and I'll feel so much better.
When's Tamika coming back? I asked her.
She's flown the coop with the others.
I thought about that, how we'd gone off together like loons, with just our thoughts down the highway. We'd almost flown the coop then, but they'd sent a big boy after us.
Hey, don't give me that look.
My mother turned me around by the shoulders, rubbed a rough towel over my back and neck.
Don't you feel clean at least?
I'm cold, I said.
Just feel clean for a second, okay? Just feel good.
She was crying then, I could tell. I wasn't facing her, but I could hear her nose dragging with snot.
We're starting over. You and me. I'm trying to get God on our side, do things different, so you can be a happy little kid again, got it? Can you just be a regular little kid for 1 second, please?
I wasn't sure what else I could be.
How hard could it be to smile? Once,
she begged. Then she crawled around on her hands and knees so she was facing me again. She found the measuring cup, set it on the very top of her head, lifted up her hands.
Magic, she breathed.
She had tears on her face, a tight-lipped grin, hair that was getting wet from the cup. After a moment, her measuring hat clattered to the floor.
Last resort, she warned.
She tickled under my armpits, so I squirmed away.
Now, how hard was that?
She said, letting me go. I was breathing faster and faster, trying to get it going into a laugh.
Why does the fool carry a rucksack?
I asked Rom, pulling up on his blue carpet like grass, moving back and forth with my hand. It was late. All our beer bottles were empty. Our burritos gone. He shrugged.
He's a vagabond, a traveler.
What's foolish about that? Well, he's walking off a precipice, for one.
I hadn't seen that. I looked at the card again, and it was true. The fool's right leg dangled over a cliff, but the fool's eyes were closed. He was just walking along, la-di-da.
Rom leaned in closer so I could smell his burrito breath.
But it's not all bad to let yourself fall.
Try it.
He kissed me, open-mouthed, pushing me back slowly to the carpet. The metal pin in his tongue roamed in and probed my gums. That felt good, I thought. That felt a lot like being wanted.
Wait, I said, figuring out what he meant. I got out from under him. I'm not the fool.
But you're not staying, are you?
I stood up, straightened my twisted jeans.
Not the whole night, if that's what you mean.
I mean, for good.
There was an edge to his voice I didn't expect. You're going back to ass crack Nowheresville, eventually.
No, I said.
But as I gathered my jacket from the floor, as I stuffed the burrito papers back in the soggy bag, I found myself adding, my mom doesn't even know where I am. I split after my dad died without telling her anything.
She's guilty, he said.
My mom?
I turned around.
No, the traveler.
That girl there, with her rucksack.
Piss off, I said. You don't know me.
He shrugged.
Go on, fool. The night I got back from the Tall Ships Festival in Duluth, I lay in my loft for a long time. The light from the lamp below drawing moths, flies, mosquitoes. They crawled in through cracks in the screens, through minute gaps in the door and window frames. My mother sat at the table below waiting for me to come and talk to her. I could hear her weight shifting, the pine floorboards growing beneath her. I could sense that she wanted me to climb down the ladder, to let gravity take me by the ankles, to sit with her and tell her about Duluth. She wanted me to want to tell her about Patra and her family, at last, so she could deride them and their middle-class values, but at the same time be proud of me for getting along so well, for knowing how the world worked, for not fighting it like she had and did. I could sense her waiting for this. And if I did that, if I told her about the Denny's soup and the maroon and white hotel, she'd make the gardeners seem trivial and bland, utterly ordinary.
Don't give me that look, she'd say. What's that thing in your hair? She'd ask.
She'd notice the headband right away and laugh at it and call me a teenager. Which I was. What else could I be? So I acted like one. There was a window in the loft, a small square of glass, which I sometimes propped open in the summer with a wedge of pine. After a long period of failing to sleep, I pushed that window open, shimmied out. I was wiry as anything back then, and pulled myself onto a slowly swaying pine near the back of the cabin. Then I swung myself around and leapt a few feet down onto the roof of the shed. My dad would hear that and think it was a branch falling or a raccoon. He never took account of sounds like me. 90-pound things blew down in the course of a regular night in the woods. It was nothing. I was nothing. I kept my gaze from traveling across the lake to the gardener's place, whose lights would ruin my night vision. I let night do its work on my eyes. Gradually, objects transfigured in the darkness. Real tree branches emerged from the shadows of tree branches, and though clouds had come in, I found my way easily off the shed. At first, I simply wanted to put distance between myself and the cabin, moving toward the lake out of habit. But once I got there, my dad's banged-up Winona was waiting for me to climb in. For the thousandth time,
I appreciated the waveless passage that was a canoe ride anywhere. I barely lifted the paddle. The boat moved all on its own. "You want to know what Jung would say?" Rom asked me. I stood in his doorway with my burrito bag. "The archetypal fool is Peter Pan." He used a British accent to say it. He scrunched his nose. "Blah, blah, blah," I said. "It's true. Girl Scout youth in gold-tip shoes, with a pet and a lunch packed." I zipped up my jacket, cradled my trash. I felt attacked, and at the same time sorry for him. "You said you'd do my past, not the fucking future." "Same thing in this case." Chapter 13. That the house across the lake was darker than I thought it would be, the night sky brighter, that true night had yet to show itself. I noticed these things only gradually. I dug my paddle deep into the leaf-flecked water. It was only June, but fall, it seemed, had already come to ruin a few aspens. I was still dressed for a day in Duluth. I hadn't taken off my tennis shoes in the loft or my good jeans, which were starting to feel tight in the crotch as I shoved in with the paddle. Patra's headband pulsed around my head plaintively. "Please, please, please," it went as I paddled along. I didn't mean to go anywhere. I simply meant to leave. I let the wind and the lake take me where they would. After a few cool minutes, I set the wooden handle across my knees and let myself glide. My temples were pounding. The ache in my head had moved by then into my jaw and skull, making me queasy, making me realize that we hadn't stopped for dinner on the way home from Duluth. Breakfast and lunch combined had been a few naughty strawberries. When this occurred to me, when I realized I hadn't really eaten all day, I began to feel truly sick. The sensation came over me in a pounce. I could tell the feeling had been hovering over me for hours, just waiting till I was out in the open, out on the lake, before bearing down. I was dizzy, lightheaded. By the time the canoe ran ashore, the whole world was swaying when I looked around. Still lake, no longer still at all. I climbed from the canoe carefully, gripping the sides with both hands. And though I hadn't planned on it, I wasn't surprised now to be clamoring over the wet rocks below the gardener's deck. I hardly had a thought in my head. I was just hungry and tired and fully dressed, unwilling to look back at the cabin where my mother sat, her hands sticky with pear. I snuck around to the front door. No, I wasn't, I told the police later, thinking of Paul. I was thinking about finding myself something to eat. I figured I could go right in the front door. I knew it was never locked, and scrounge around for some of Paul's pretzels in the cabinet. I knew I could do this without waking anyone up, chew without making a sound, leave without anyone noticing what had been taken. But once I had that thought, pretzels, maybe a granola bar, I realized I wanted more than that. That I would open the fridge and eat straight from the carton of cottage cheese, fish the last two pickles from the jar with my fingers, suck all Paul's leftover noodles from his bowl. I would do all that, and maybe I'd also go into the dark bathroom and pee, silently trickling it out, slip their half-used bar of lavender soap into my pocket, take Patra's cell phone from the counter, push Leo's manuscript under my shirt. I felt almost giddy at the thought. Hadn't I planned this out long ago? It suddenly seemed I had. But of course, it wasn't a true plan at all. Only the pulsing in my head. That old yearning to take far more than was reasonable. Fee, fi, fo, fum, I thought, as I spun the cool doorknob, went in. The main room was hard to make out in the dark. I saw the big triangular windows first, and through them the narrow strip of light I'd traveled from my parents' lit house. Out of habit, I wiggled out of my tennis shoes and set them against the wall. I started toward the cupboard in my socks. I was thinking of snacks in crinkly packages. I was hoping for peanut butter granola bars, nestled snugly in boxes. The hinge on the cupboard made a throaty sound, and I no sooner had the box in my hands, the cupboard closed, when a tingling went up the back of my neck.
Linda?
I turned. Patra sat in a shadow on the couch. She stood up slowly, a black silhouette against the window, and I had the fleeting absurd belief that if I didn't say anything, if I froze in my tracks, she wouldn't see me. Is that you? I stayed quiet and didn't move. Oh, dear, she said. She was wearing just a t-shirt, and her bare legs looked pale as birch branches in the dark. She didn't bother tugging the hem over her thighs as she came across the room. What is it?
Wait, Leo forgot to pay you, didn't he?
Or did you forget your bag in the car? Good grief, Linda. I saw you coming across the lake. I watched you, and I thought, I had this thought. She's come to rescue us. That girl in her boat. Isn't it weird the things you think in the dark? Isn't it funny how the mind goes flap, 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 so you don't know if you're sleeping or not, and you think that girl, that crazy girl in her canoe has come to row us all away somewhere?
Paddle, I whispered.
What?
She asked. You row a boat, paddle a canoe.
Whatever, yes.
She put a hand on her head, so her t-shirt pulled up over her panties. I'm talking nonsense.
I must have dozed off before I looked out the window and saw you. Did Leo forget to write a check, or did you come for something else?
Why did I come?
My stomach rumbled audibly, and as it did, I took in the room more fully. I saw the closed picnic basket on the counter, the cell phone in Patra's hand, and the way she stroked it compulsively while she watched my face, while she waited for an explanation. I looked over and saw that Paul's door was shut. A crack of light shone beneath it. And as Patra's head turned, as she followed my gaze, I became aware of Leo's voice behind it talking quietly. Patra reached for the light switch, and an odd panic washed over me.
Wait. We're all up, I guess. May as well admit it. But
some part of me still wanted to sneak away unseen.
No one can sleep tonight.
Paul's door opened, and Leo came out. Patra flicked on the light, and the two of us were left squinting in the sudden brightness. Leo stood open-eyed, surprised, no, dismayed, to see me.
What? He said,
and for an instant a look of real fear passed over his face. I thought of that first morning when I'd met him with the hatchet as soon as he came into the house. Then he'd taken me as harmless, hardly worth noticing. He'd shaken my hand, introduced himself, poured glasses of juice for the both of us. Now he was acting as though I might be dangerous to him, and maybe I was. I wanted to be. But not in the way he thought. Discreetly, I set the box of granola bars on the counter behind the picnic basket, crossed my arms.
Linda? He asked.
You forgot to pay her, Patra said.
Did I?
He was watching me intently. He seemed about to call me out for showing up unannounced, then appeared to think better of it.
I did. I guess I did forget.
Like me, he was still wearing his clothes from the day, his khaki shorts and tucked-in shirt. But he also wore his black slippers. They flapped loose on his feet as he moved across the room to the table and began to write a check. A sound came from the other room, a murmur or cry.
He's hungry, Leo explained, bending over the checkbook. We'll have pancakes, I think. That's one of those foods no one can turn down. He's ready for breakfast.
It couldn't have been much past 11 o'clock. The night sky had been bright when I paddled across the lake, the clouds a curdled gray over the moon. At the latest, it was just before midnight now. But for a moment it seemed possible I'd lost track of time, that the whole night had passed without my noticing. Had I fallen asleep in the loft? Was it dawn I'd seen in the sky? Breakfast! Patra looked as confused as I, as muddled.
Yep.
He glanced up from his task. It's early, but not two.
And where is it? It says you can't eat breakfast a little early. Who wrote that rule down?
He ripped out the check and handed it to me. Here, he said. And I saw that he'd written out $150. It was more money than I'd seen at once in my life, and yet so flimsy, so much less substantial than the $10 bills Patra gave me. The line for my name he left blank.
Let's let Linda be on her way.
Patra unexpectedly grasped my arm.
Why not stay for breakfast?
It's been a long, long day for her, Leo warned.
We should have stopped on the way home,
Patra complained to him. It wouldn't have been such a long day if we'd stopped.
He was sleeping. It's good to let him sleep.
But he's hungry now. I think he could eat a horse, Leo told her. And since he got to sleep all day, he's awake now. He's awake and telling stories.
That's good,
her voice splintered.
That's good.
He took her by one hand, walked her to the couch, sat her down. Then he crouched in front of her, kissing her face, over and over. He kissed her cheeks, the wrinkles on her forehead, her freckled eyelids. She was still worrying the cell phone with a thumb, but I could sense something in her smoothing out, like a hand over bed covers after a long, bad night. I hadn't seen Leo like this before, and it was mesmerizing to watch. He brushed the hair from her face, the way I'd seen Patra brush the hair from Paul's. He said to her softly,
"So, I figure, let's have breakfast, right? Let's start tomorrow early. It's not written anywhere that we can't do that."
"It's tomorrow?"
Patra asked.
"Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
And
we're just having breakfast. Pancakes and syrup and strawberries and milk."
At that, my mouth filled with saliva, and Leo went into the kitchen and started pulling out pots and pans. He paused to put in a CD.
"A little music?"
he asked over his shoulder. And then something classical with strings bloomed steadily into the room. Patra, who'd been glancing at Paul's open doorway, set her cell phone on the coffee table. Once the phone was out of her hands, Leo started to relax.
"Well, bye, Linda,"
he said to me across the kitchen island, never looking in my direction, taking for granted that I was on my way out the door. His eyes were fixed on Patra, on her strange, jittery walk from couch to hall.
"Maybe don't bother him now,"
he called to her, a pot in hand. "But he's awake. He's fine."
"He's awake?"
She looked back at Leo.
"He woke up a few minutes ago. He must be hungry. He asked for breakfast."
So breakfast is what Leo made. He turned on all the lights in the main room and kitchen, went around flicking every switch. He filled a pot with water to warm the syrup bottle, and within a minute or two had stirred a golden batter, which he ladled in bubbly, spreading pools onto the skillet. As he did this, as he dabbed at the pancakes with the tip of his spatula, he kept quietly suggesting that I leave.
"There's your check, Linda," he said. "Thanks so much again."
"No problem," I said, as the warm, doughy scent of pancakes filled the room.
"It was a huge help to have you, you know. So, thanks. A huge, huge help." He smiled without looking up, his forehead shining with steam.
Let me do something, I offered. Let me pour the milk. That's really nice of you, but I'm sure you're tired.
Not really, I said.